Well, No Nonsense Nutrition never runs out of stuff to talk about 7+ years. There's always something happening in the health and nutrition arena. There's always something happening new. And so that's the reason that I'm an education junkie, trying to go to as many events as I can and just learning one more thing that might help one more person. And boy, did that happen over the last 4 days. I was in Orlando at a conference and, you know, got to share time with the Science Medical Board of Advisors that I sit on, sit in the room with 28 of the smartest people that I know for a couple of days and make formulas and share clinical pearls. And then 2 more days in a conference with some of the best docs from all over the United States, literally around the world, sharing information on the synthesis of studies. You know, there's an arena known as transitional science. And I've talked about Dr. Joe Evans' work on the air before, because transitional scientists take the information that comes from the studies and translate it into products and strategies that we can use. And so this is the piece that I'm very interested in, because it's really where the rubber meets the road. And one of my favorites, Dr. David Perlmutter, was there as the opening salvo of this particular talk. And I would like to tip my hat right away to David Perlmutter, a neurologist down in Naples, who has absolutely been a holistic pioneer in the neurological community over the 17 or 18 years that I've known him and shared patients with him. Anytime I had somebody come to me who had had a stroke or had seizures or had MS or, you know, had gait problems, I always shipped them all the way down to Naples to Dr. Perlmutter, because I really saw that he used some of the most holistic cutting-edge strategies in dealing with these neurological problems. Well, one of the things that I like about what he does is the synthesis of taking the studies and figuring out, as clinicians, what do we do with that information? How do we advise people as a result of what the new studies are? And, you know, I had one of our listeners over on WMNF call up one time and say every time he listened to my show, he got a little scared. And, you know, it's never, never, ever my purpose to scare anybody. But awareness is the first step. And sometimes we have to be aware of what the potential hazard is to our health in order that we can make the lifestyle modifications that change things. You know, when I do my new client class at my clinic every month, I always ask for a show of hands how many people are looking forward to 5 years in a nursing home. Yeah, it is pretty sarcastic, because you know darn good and well nobody's going to raise their hand and say, yeah, I'm really looking forward to 5 or 10 years in a nursing home drooling on myself and waiting for somebody to come in and change my diapers. But unfortunately, it happens to too many people. And so where you have a chance to change that trajectory is today, literally today. And one of the ways that you can change that trajectory is to not be part of the American statistics that have to do with eating sugar. You know, how much sugar is America eating? And you can read different sets of stats, but the one that absolutely looks the most solid is about 130 pounds a year. And so if you're not eating 130 pounds of sugar and I'm not eating 130 pounds of sugar, then there's somebody out there that's probably eating a pound a day. You know, back in 1822, and I'm sure all of you remember 1822, Americans didn't consume very much sugar. The amount that's found in one 12-ounce can of soda is about 45 grams of sugar. And it was common back in 1822, almost 200 years ago, that people consumed that amount about every 5 days. So you got the relationship now? 45 grams of sugar every 5 days. That's less than 10 grams of sugar a day. In 2012, it changed pretty remarkably. You know, our sugar consumption went from 20 to 40 to 60 to 80 to 100 pounds a year over that period of time from 1820 to 2012. And now we're in a situation that instead of consuming 45 grams of sugar every 5 days, we're consuming 785 grams of sugar every 5 days. Yeah, you heard me right. 785 grams of sugar every 5 days. That's a lot. That's a really lot. The average American is now consuming 3 pounds of sugar every week, over 3,500 pounds of sugar in their lifetime. That's as much as a car weighs. So when we look at that sweet tooth, why are we concerned? Are we concerned because you're going to get tooth decay? Are we concerned because you're going to gain weight? No, my primary concern is that you're going to become diabetic. And so the nature of understanding that the fundamental source of that sugar is high fructose corn syrup, and the fundamental source of high fructose corn syrup is soda pop, then we need to understand that until such time as we start treating soda pop as the evil empire, then we're not going to make very big inroads in changing health in America. It's real simple for us to look back at that period of time that began in the 1970s and certainly escalated up through the 1990s, where we said high fat was dangerous, that we needed to all eat low-fat diets. Well, you know what? I'm going to give you some stats today that are going to disprove that. That the high-fat diet was not the biggest challenge. It is, in fact, the high-carb diet, but most notably, the high-sugar diet that's doing it. When we look at the sheer volume of diabetes that are and let me stop for a minute and talk about what diabetes is, because it's a group of diseases. And when we eat food, that food breaks down and proteins break down into amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of tissue, and they're also the building blocks. They make all of your hormones, all your enzymes, all your neurotransmitters. All of those things are made out of the amino acids that are parts of proteins. So it's real easy to visualize a protein just like you're thinking about the alphabet. You've got 26 letters in the alphabet, and they make tens of thousands of different words. You've got 20 plus amino acids, and they make thousands of different proteins. Different combinations of letters make different words. Different combinations of amino acids make different proteins. So you might have a different protein in your skin than you have in your fingernails, than you have in your hair, than you have that makes a neurotransmitter or a hormone or an enzyme, but all of them are made out of amino acids. When we eat fats, fats break down into fatty acids. Long-chain fatty acids, short-chain fatty acids, but they're pieces of fats or lipids. But when we eat carbohydrates, and remember, all carbohydrate means is something grows out of the ground. If it's a fruit or a vegetable, if it's a grain or a bean or a nut or a seed, it's a carb. I always try to keep that trick question saved, which is there are only two carbohydrates that don't grow out of the ground. Do you know what they are? Remember that, only two carbohydrates are not plants. Otherwise, all carbs mean are plants. A lot of people think carbs mean white flour and white potatoes and white rice and white sugar. Those are some examples of carbs. But broccoli is a carb, and celery is a carb, and apples are a carb, and lettuce is a carb. So carbs break down into glucose. No, I haven't forgotten the question. What are the two carbs that don't come from plants? Honey, coming from bees, and lactose. Remember, if it ends in an OSE, it's a sugar. So the sugar that's in milk naturally, not sugar that you added, but just the sugar that's a natural part of milk, that is a carbohydrate. So honey, half fructose, half glucose, and lactose from milk, that's it. Those are the only carbs that don't grow out of the ground. So when we eat carbohydrates, we break down the complex starches. So if you had a sweet potato for dinner last night, or you had corn pudding, which I had for dinner last night, then you're going to break that starch down into glucose. Starch is just nothing but a whole bunch of sugars holding hands together. So proteins break down into amino acids, and fats break down into fatty acids, and carbohydrates break down into glucose. And when we have high levels of glucose in the blood, the pancreas, that kind of accordioned organ that sits over there on the left side of your stomach, just above your waistline, it's a very cool organ. It manufactures both enzymes and hormones, so it's a factory that makes cars and trucks. And the pancreas manufactures insulin, and insulin is fundamentally designed to store calories. It allows glucose to get into the cell, but it's a storage hormone more than it is anything else. And so when our blood glucose levels rise, our pancreas secretes insulin. And if it doesn't secrete any insulin at all, because the cells that are inside the pancreas that manufacture insulin don't work, then we call that diabetes type 1. Used to be called insulin-dependent diabetes or juvenile onset diabetes. It's about 5% of all the diabetes cases. But this is a place where the pancreas just doesn't work. The islets of Langerhans, the parts inside the pancreas that manufacture insulin, don't work. It's considered an autoimmune disease. And we know there's a 14-fold chance of it happening for individuals who drink cow's milk before their first birthday. That's why all you holistic moms out there that are listening, that have done the right thing and you've kept your baby on the breast, or if your baby isn't on the breast and you've had your baby on formula, you know darn good and well you don't want to pour cow's milk into that bottle, because you're going to increase your baby's risk of juvenile onset or type 1 diabetes. The other kind of diabetes, type 2 diabetes, used to be called non-insulin dependent or adult onset diabetes. Well, we can't call it adult onset diabetes anymore, because now we see it in children. It was just a little more than a decade ago that we saw the first case in a teenager, and now we're actually seeing adult onset diabetes in 9-year-olds. It's about 90 or 95% of all the diagnosed cases of diabetes in adults. And as I said, it's increasingly being diagnosed in children and adolescents. The third type, very small number, is gestational diabetes, which occurs in less than 10% of all pregnancies, and generally occurs in the second half of the pregnancy. But women who have gestational diabetes have a much higher chance of becoming diabetic, as do their babies. So the nature of diabetes is, with type 1, which is an autoimmune disease, once it gets rocking, right now we don't know how to stop it. But type 2, well, it's preventable. Because diabetes can lead to very serious complications and premature death, we want to do something to control our risk. And, you know, there's a lot of people who think that, oh, if I get diabetic, all I have to do is take metformin or Januvia or one of those things that they advertise on the news at night, and that'll take care of me. No, it doesn't. Just as individuals that come into my practice on a regular basis who have elevated fasting blood sugar and, more dangerously, elevated hemoglobin A1C, HA1C, hemoglobin A1C, is a measurement of how much your blood glucose has been on average over the prior 3 months. Hemoglobin A1Cs are really a better measurement of your blood glucose standard than taking a fasting glucose. Because a lot of people, when their pancreas starts to get wonky, and you have to know that that's an official clinical medical scientific term, wonky, as their pancreas starts to get a little wonky, their fasting blood sugar may be normal, but their insulin levels are very high. In other words, we're keeping the blood sugar normal, but we're doing so by cranking out too much insulin. So they often refer to that group of people, probably about 2 million of them, as pre-diabetic. Well, I got news for you. Of the 80 million adults in the United States who fall into that category called pre-diabetes, where the blood glucose levels are higher than normal, but not high enough to be called diabetes, well, pre-diabetes is kind of like being sort of pregnant. You is or you isn't. And so, you know, do you become diabetic when your fasting blood sugar is 126, but when it's 125, you're not diabetic? Hello? Let's pay attention here that the progression to diabetes can be changed by losing weight, by increasing physical activity, and by changing what you eat on a regular basis. So I think pre-diabetes is a pretty bogus diagnosis, just like pre-hypertension is a bogus diagnosis. But when we look at the fact that almost 10%, 26 million Americans have diabetes, 8.5% of the U.S. population, 7 million of them don't even know they have the disease. We don't want to have diabetes. And I know there's some of you listening who have already been diagnosed with diabetes, and what I'm going to do is help you to find a way out of this morass. No, we may not be able to cure the diabetes, but we can certainly slow the progression, and we can keep you off insulin. Because what we want to understand is that diabetes increases the risk of dementia. Yeah, it's a scary thing to think about. One out of two people at age 85 have Alzheimer's disease. That's really lousy odds. And so when we look at the relative risk of Alzheimer's disease, we know that that relative risk doubles when people are diabetic. You have twice as big a risk of developing Alzheimer's disease if you're diabetic than you do if you don't have diabetes. And if, in fact, you're an insulin diabetic, then insulin-dependent diabetic, your risk of Alzheimer's increases more than fourfold. Those are pretty lousy odds. And so when we look at the risk of dementia, I have to tell you that things have changed markedly in my practice over the last 10 years, where prior to that, I don't think I ever had a client walk in my clinic and say, what I'm really concerned about is losing my mind. What I'm really concerned about is not just losing the keys, but forgetting what the keys are for. But I'll tell you, in the last decade, that has greatly changed. Because a lot of people realize that as they age, something might break or not work as well or wear out. But boy, the thing they don't want to have wear out is what's going on between their ears. So if you want to maintain your good mind as you age, the day to do something about your sugar consumption is today. Because we know that there is an absolutely direct relationship between the amount of sugar you consume and the risk of diabetes. And there is an absolutely indirect relationship between diabetes and increasing your risk of dementia, of Alzheimer's, and all the rest of the kinds of dementia. You've heard me say before, I took classes over at University of South Florida. You know, they have the big Johnny Bird Center for Alzheimer's Research over there. And Dr. Gary Arendash, one of the real gurus of the Johnny Bird Center, I've taken several classes from. And Dr. Arendash made it, you know, really quite clear that there are 54 kinds of dementia. Alzheimer's makes up 70% of all the dementia, but, you know, of the 30% that's left, there's 53 different varieties of dementia. And I tried to make it a little light by saying I got dementia learning 53 kinds of dementia, even though that's not really very funny. So when we look at the prevalence of diagnosed and undiagnosed diabetes, we know that, you know, as we get more miles on the odometer, meaning individuals that are 65 and older, that we've got more than 25% of this age group that has diabetes. You know, when we look at people 20 and older, we're looking at 11 to 12% of individuals who have diabetes. So if you're in that category under 65 years old and you don't want to double your risk of diabetes, today's the day to put away the soda. Today's the day to put away the iced tea that has high fructose corn syrup in it. You know, a lot of you think you're moving up a notch because you don't buy something with bubbles, because you don't buy soda pop. And so you get a green tea with pomegranate in it or something that sounds like it's got healthy attitude, but you never turned the bottle around and saw there were 330 calories in that glass of iced tea. And those calories came from some sweetener. So if it wasn't high fructose corn syrup, it was sugar. And if it wasn't sugar, it was agave. And I'll tell you, I am anti-agave all over the place. If you think agave is better for you than sugar, well, then think again. Because too much agave has been found to be contaminated with mercury as a result of the machinery that's used. And the agave plant in the Sonoran Desert, which is out in the southwest in Arizona, New Mexico, and northern Mexico, the plant is threatened environmentally. And, you know, this is the home to a lot of animals out there in the desert southwest. So you've got an ecological issue when it comes to agave, and you've got a toxicity issue with when it comes to agave. And not only that, you're paying 10 times more than you pay for a bag of sugar when you're buying it. Over and over again, we want to see that what changes. How does this happen? What changes when we're taking in all the sugar? What is hemoglobin A1C? Well, remember, there's a foundational law of chemistry, and that foundational law of chemistry is you change the shape of the molecule, you change the function of a molecule. Now, you need to have that tattooed on your brain, because that is such an important foundational piece of information for those of you that want to become good students of health. You change the shape of a molecule, you change the function of a molecule. It doesn't work the same way. And you're going to see a tremendous amount of research over the next decade about how proteins fold. You know, proteins have to condense in size to get into certain spaces to attach onto the cell wall. And so it's the same thing in your house. If you've got a blanket that you're going to put in the hall closet, you don't just wad it up and shove it in the closet. You fold it. You make it take less space. Well, that's the same thing that happens with proteins. So here's these proteins floating around in your bloodstream, and here's all the sugar floating around in your bloodstream, and the sugar can attach to a protein. And that's called a glycosylated protein. We hook glucose to a protein. And now we change the shape of the protein. And so when we change the shape of the protein, we change how we fold it. And when we change that, we change the function of the protein. You know, there's not a lot of good analogies here, but the one that I often use with clients is, think about it when you get a key made. Have you ever gone to the key shop and you've had them cut you a new key and they didn't do it really clean and there's a little burr that's left on the key, and you go home and you stick it in your doorknob and it won't turn? And you hold the key next to your original key, and you see there's just this one little teeny bump on that key that keeps it from disengaging the tumblers in the lock. Exactly the same thing can happen inside your cell. If you change the shape of the molecule, you change the function of the molecule. So we make these things called advanced glycosylation end products. Oh yeah, you know it doesn't roll off your tongue, but it will, because you're going to find out that we use AGE as the way to reference it. They are the age molecules, advanced glycosylation end products. Okay, so now we've got another mental picture for you, a loaf of bread. If you've ever made bread, you know the dough is homogeneous. All the dough looks alike when you put it in the pan and you stick it in the oven. But after it's been baking for an hour, you find out that there's a crust on the outside, and the crust is harder and browner and denser, but the inside is still the nice doughy, gooey stuff that we're looking forward to. Well, they're all made out of the same thing, so how come they're different? Because the heat has affected those molecules on the outside and created that crust. Well, do you ever look in the back of your hand and see spots? Hello, that's crust. You ever look at your face and see spots? Well, maybe you were born with freckles because you're a redhead. But for a lot of us, as we age, we get more spots. And we don't necessarily like those spots. Those are ages. Those are advanced glycosylation end products. Those are post-translation modifications of proteins. Do you love this language? Post-translational modifications of proteins. It's when an amino group reacts with a single sugar, with a monosaccharide. And so you might have gotten the mailer. One of the Vitamin Hustler companies send out a mailer that said, if you've got spots on your skin, you've got spots in your brain. And that's, you know, awful, but kind of true. When we look at the ages, we can measure them with several different kinds of tests, tests called T-bar tests. They're not very popular today, but I guarantee you they're going to become more popular over time. And if you listen to No Nonsense Nutrition, just to improve your vocabulary, you can think of thiobarbituric reactive substances. Again, ages sound easy now, but these T-bars are one of the ways that we measure that the fats have gone rancid in your brain. Ooh, rancid fats in your brain. Ooh, you don't want that to happen. I guarantee you, you don't want it to happen. And so we don't want to hook these sugars to a protein, and we don't want to let fats get rancid in our brain, because these are the things that change the actual volume of the brain. We end up with brain atrophy, and I guarantee you, you don't want brain and atrophy in the same sentence. But the statistic that Dr. Perlmutter gave at the conference in Orlando that really blew my socks off was the relationship between that brain volume change and what your hemoglobin A1C number is. So the next time you go to the doctor and you get your blood work done, you get your CBC, which is your complete blood count, and your CMP, which is your comprehensive metabolic profile, make sure you add a couple of things to that test. Add vitamin D. You've heard me talk about vitamin D enough here on No Nonsense Nutrition. And if you haven't heard enough, go up on the Facebook page and look for the podcast on vitamin D. But the other one is hemoglobin A1C. Comes out as a percentage number. And the higher that number, the greater the reduction of brain volume. We really don't want to lose brain volume as we age. And I guarantee you, it doesn't just happen in Washington, D.C., although oftentimes Washington, D.C. demonstrates what it's like to lose brain volume. We have what's called hippocampal atrophy. And again, these are, you don't want to hear the word atrophy when you're talking about the body. So we see an association between type 2 diabetes and cerebral atrophy, which means we see a relationship to cognitive impairment. The dementia is accumulating. You know, relatively little is known about these subclinical effects of high plasma glucose levels. But what we clearly see is in the hippocampus, we can give somebody an MRI and then go back 5 years later and see another MRI and find out that people that have diabetes have lost more brain than they have otherwise. So the amygdala and the hippocampus, these are the places in the brain you want to protect. You want to protect them by reducing your stress. So maybe you have stress as a result of listening to this show. Maybe you don't want to learn these things. Maybe you'd rather just, you know, go darkly into the night and slug back your big gulp and not worry about the fact that you can't find your keys or know what your keys are for. But I got news for you. I don't want to be in that list. When we begin to look at the fact that we can make a change, one of the ways that we can make a change is to reduce the total volume of sugar that's going into our body. Because we damage the lipids, we damage the proteins, we damage the DNA, we damage the RNA. Free radical mediated oxidative damage. Got it? Free radical mediated oxidative damage. We rust. We turn rancid as we age. And it plays a role in the development of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. It's all about oxidative damage. Why do we take antioxidants? You know, when I get these people and they say, oh, you can do it all with your diet. You don't have to use supplements. You're out of your freaking mind. There isn't any way that you can do it all with your diet in the society that we've created. Did you see the movies yesterday? The stuff on the news about what was going on with the air pollution in China? You know, years ago when I would go to Los Angeles six times a year, they said, you know, we don't trust air, we can't see. Well, you didn't have any problem seeing it in Beijing yesterday. The amount of damage that is done to a brain in one day of that kind of lousy air pollution is equivalent to years of smoking. So when we begin to look at the fact that we can't do it all with food, we've got to bring the supplements to the party because we have environmental stresses that did not occur in the evolutionary world. When I was in the hotel in Orlando this weekend, I spent Wednesday night there, and then I was at my conference all day Thursday. And when we walked back to our room on Thursday night, there was wet paint signs all along the hall. And so even if I did nothing but walk up and down that hall twice a day, I was exposed to the fumes that were coming off of that paint. We need to understand that these environmental exposures may be small, but they're cumulative. Every time I went into the restroom, they had one of those, I call them stinky machines, those automatic air fresheners that go psh, psh, and spray out a blast of parabens and nasty fragrance chemicals to keep the bathroom smelling springtime fresh. Well, I would just as soon not be exposed to that stuff. But I didn't have a choice if I'm going to be in that hotel. So I got gas off from the new carpet fibers in the classroom. I got paint in the hall. I've got stinky, you know, fragrances in the bathrooms. And I guarantee you that the hotel food was not the most superlative stuff I ever saw. I can't stack the deck against that. I can be eating all the organic blueberries that are, you know, in my takeout container this morning with the papaya that came off my tree and the non-organic pineapple that almost never has pesticides on it and have my plain yogurt with it. You know I eat that every Monday. You listen to No Nonsense Nutrition. You know what my food diary is. But I can't overcome 4 days of hotel food and environmental toxins without supplements. And what's the first one that's going to be on the list? It's going to be alpha-lipoic acid. Alpha-lipoic acid, because too many diabetics end up with neuropathy. 60 to 70% of them end up where they can't feel their feet. And alpha-lipoic acid, time-released alpha-lipoic acid, that's the key. Because alpha-lipoic acid is a great nutrient, but it peaks really quickly and falls really quickly. So going to the 600 milligram time-released alpha-lipoic acid is really a big key. And we get more bang for our buck than just protecting our nerve sheaths and reducing our hemoglobin A1C with alpha-lipoic acid. We help to get heavy metals out of the body with ALA, alpha-lipoic acid. You know, the 60 to 70% of individuals that have diabetes that end up with neuropathy where they can't feel their toes, about 25% of them get an ulcer on their foot, and 1 out of 5 of them have an amputation. You know, we have 96,000 non-traumatic amputations that happen in this country. And once again, I can't imagine that if I asked for a show of hands of how many of you are really looking forward to salami chopping on your toes, then your foot, then your lower leg, I don't think I'm going to get very many hands, especially when we find out that 50% of them that have an amputation get another limb amputated in 2 years. You know, when I was following the landmine campaign that Yoko Ono had created, I found out that somebody loses a limb to a landmine every 30 minutes. But what I had to realize is somebody loses a limb to diabetes every 30 seconds. Are these motivators for you? Is this a reason for you to not stop and have a big gulp today? Boy, I hope so. So what else can we use? We can use, well, even aspirin. You know, I'm a real big fan of 225 milligram aspirins a week. Not really a big fan of taking 81 milligrams every day. You know, there's just no studies about that. But 325 twice a week, I'm a fan of that. Because you're not subjecting your stomach to that aspirin every day, every day, every day. I'm also a big fan of N-acetylcysteine, NAC, it's called in the business, N-A-C. N-acetylcysteine is one of the things that raises glutathione. And you've heard me talk about glutathione a lot here on No Nonsense Nutrition because it is the preeminent antioxidant of your body. There is no single supportive nutrient that can make a bigger difference in terms of your total antioxidant density in your body than having high levels of glutathione. In the collection of nutrients that I take in the morning is a compound called S-acetylglutathione because it's one of the best protections we have against cataracts. It's one of the best protections we have about toxic exposure like paint fumes coming off the wall. Resveratrol. And resveratrol coming out of a capsule, methylated resveratrol, that's the good stuff. Not just throwing down a whole bunch of red wine. You know, a lot of people go, oh, red wine's got resveratrol in it. Well, the capsule that I take is equivalent to 27 bottles of red wine. And you might be able to drink 27 bottles of red wine today, but you ain't going to do it again tomorrow. So using things like alpha-lipoic acid and N-acetylcysteine and resveratrol and aspirin and DHA, you know, that half of the fish oil molecule of EPA and DHA, these are things that help stop T-bars. These are the things that help stop the creation of advanced glycosylated end products, the AGEs. You know, if we want to reduce our risk, we can reduce our risk and we can do it today. There isn't any doubt about it. And we can do it with a lifestyle change like not taking these concentrated sugars in. So we try to make something a bad guy. And then we try to find a drug to moderate it. And you know, the biggest cash cow that we have ever had in the United States have been statin drugs. You know, if you're holding stock with any of the big drug companies, you know, the place that you've made the most money has been on statin drugs. And yet to find out that women who use statin drugs increase their risk of diabetes 71%. You hear it? Women who take statin drugs increase their risk of diabetes 71%. The risk of diabetes is the threat. The cholesterol is not the threat. When we begin to look at statin use in the risk of diabetes in postmenopausal women, we know that we're altering the cell membranes. And in altering the cell membranes, we change the way that the body uses sugar. And that's really the issue overall. And so it's important for us to realize that changing our current pattern of prescribing cholesterol-raising medications is going to take some period of time. Individuals are not going to be very willing, physicians are not going to be very willing, to change their party line, to change the very way that they prescribe because they've been doing it for so long. When we change our current practice pattern from physicians not recommending cholesterol drugs, we're going to actually see a decrease in the number of cases that are going to happen with diabetes. But that's a huge psychological shift for physicians because, you know, they've been used to saying, oh, your cholesterol is high. We ought to just put you on a diabetes medication. But in fact, that's not necessarily in your best interest. First, you're going to get the statin drug, and then you're going to get the diabetes drug laid on top of it. But total cholesterol and the risk of all-cause mortality is really important to understand, because every time you increase cholesterol by 40 milligrams, you have a 15% decrease in mortality risk. Oh my God, what did she just say? What I just said was, if your cholesterol is higher, you live longer. Yeah. If your cholesterol is higher, you live longer. If your cholesterol is higher, you have less issues with dementias. If your cholesterol is higher, you have better cognitive brain function. And yet, we have been convinced that cholesterol is the enemy. Cholesterol was never the enemy. Cholesterol-lowering therapy changes the cell membranes in such a way as we increase the risk of diabetes. You know, this is a study of 160,000 women. This is no small potatoes when it comes to this study. So when we begin to understand that the changes that can happen are profound changes, the changes that can happen are changes that begin with the first pill. And so you think you're going to reduce your risk of heart disease by taking cholesterol medication? Well, then think again. We have an opportunity every single solitary day to decide whether we want to get more alive or more dead. And so every meal, every plate of food that we eat gives us an opportunity to decide whether we're going to treat our body well or treat our body poorly. So some people are bent on self-destruction. You know them. They're your friends. They may be your family. You see them doing things that are really bad for their health, and no amount of talking is going to change it. You ever tried to talk somebody out of smoking cigarettes? Until such time as they're ready to make the change, it's very rare that lecturing, nagging, begging, cajoling, threatening is going to make a difference. You know, the same thing is true with a lot of other behaviors. But you have to decide for you what kind of future you want. You know, when individuals say, oh, we all have to go some way. Well, that's true. My father said your return flight is booked, but you just don't know where the gatehouse is. So I have no doubt whatsoever about the fact that all of us are going to take the return flight home at some point. But I want to be able to do it where I can still count my fingers and toes. I still want to be able to do it with my brain working. And so what we know now is that lowering the total amount of carbohydrate in the diet, especially the total amount of carbohydrate that comes from high fructose corn syrup and sugar, makes a huge, big difference. We need to go back to eating more fat. Dietary factors play major roles in determining whether the brain ages successfully or it experiences a neurodegenerative disease. High-calorie diets increase the risk for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and other dementias. And so we may have predisposing genes. Some of us may have genes that already put us at risk. But every meal that we eat interacts with that gene. And when we have higher fat in the diet, and you know it needs to be good fat, and the top of the list is going to be coconut oil. There is no question about the fact that coconut oil stands apart from every other source of oil as a way to enhance the brain. So the next time that you go to fix your egg, then why don't you fix your egg in coconut oil? And when you're ready to put something on top of your green beans, don't just think of butter. Think of the fact that you might put on some coconut oil. Every time you go to use oil to, you know, cook your fish, think about the possibility of cooking it in coconut oil. So when we look at every day's opportunity to do something to improve our health, Take a NAC. Taking an aspirin twice a week. Using alpha lipoic acid. Cooking with coconut oil. Leaving off the big vats of soda and lattes and, you know, all the stuff that is so incredibly sugar dense. Realizing that if we get numbers that are elevated in our fasting glucose, our fasting insulin, or our hemoglobin A1C, that we need to make a change, and we need to make a change right away. Think twice before you start on a statin drug, because when we look at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration warning, you know, this didn't come out from some yahoo nutritionist, some blonde woman in Sarasota sitting behind a microphone. This came to us from the United States Food and Drug Administration, FDA, warnings that cholesterol-lowering statins increase the risk of developing diabetes, liver injury, cognitive problems, and muscle injury for some patients. They've had to change the labels on statin medications simply because of the fact that we found that they're associated with memory loss, confusion, and an increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes. I don't want to be preachy. I don't want to be a nag. What I really want to do is be an informer. I want to inform you so that you can make a good decision. Oxidative stress hurts your brain. You want to do as little as possible that creates oxidative stress in your brain. And you can start today with lunch. Remember, bright colors are one of the ways that we find good nutrients in food. Eat a rainbow every day. When I look at that yellow pineapple and dark purple blueberries, wrongly named, and bright orange papaya, those deep, bright colors, they tell us that we've got a lot of phytonutrients in there that are good for our body and are good for our brain. Remember, the brain you save will be your own.